Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome to the Global Health Forum on Blog Talk Radio. This show is a public service of People to People, a not-for-profit 501c3 registered Ethiopian diaspora healthcare organization. I'm your host, Dr. Antana Hapte, Chairman of People to People's Board of Directors. Our topic for this evening is global health with emphasis on HIV, AIDS, and tuberculosis, both of which have been ranked among the top 10 deadliest epidemics in history. While the scorecard more than 30 years into the HIV epidemic and a death toll of more than 30 million worldwide? What are the lessons learned and how has the experience shaped our response to the more recent Ebola outbreak in West Africa? What can we expect in the next decade in terms of HIV treatment availability and accessibility, especially in resource-constrained countries? Is an HIV vaccine on the horizon? To help us answer these questions and more, we're joined this evening by Dr. Zelalem Temesgen, an infectious disease physician and a professor of medicine at Mayo Clinic, where he established and directs the Mayo Clinic HIV program, the Mayo Clinic Global HIV Education Initiative, and the Mayo Clinic Center for Tuberculosis. Dr. Zelalem is also active in the arena of medical education, both within the Mayo Clinic and outside, and has made numerous media presentations, extramural visiting professorships, and invited lectures at national and international meetings. He has served as the principal investigator for over 40 clinical trials, including site principal investigator for a number of NIH-sponsored trials. Dr. Zelalem has also served as a member of the Mayo Clinic Institutional Review Board for a number of years. Delighted to have you on the show, Dr. Zelalem.
Hello, Dr. Antana.
So why don't you start us off by defining global health to our audience and briefly describing your areas of interest in that field?
Yes. So global health, Antana, is one of those funny terms that is very popular. Almost every university has a global health office or department, and we think we understand what it is, and most of the time we do, but it's sort of harder to define. The word global is easy to understand. It means that the issues that we are dealing with are not geographically limited. They're not bound by the boundaries of a single nation. They're applicable to many countries, if not the whole world. So that is what the word global implies. And health is also a word we understand. When we say we are healthy, we mean we're not sick. And so it's a state of well-being. But it's not only a state of physical well-being, it is also a state of mental and social well-being. And the determinants of health are not just the health services, healthcare workforce, and so on, but there are things like, for example, income, education, clean air, water, safe water, and things like this. So global health is an area of activity dealing with health-related issues on a large scale, on a global scale, and that's what's understood most of the time by the term global health. There is no one universally accepted definition.
But it's much broader than the mere absence of disease.
Yeah, and that actually is a statement also often repeated by the World of Health, yes.
Okay. And then if you can proceed to describe your areas of interest in that broad field that you just defined.
So my interest is somewhat based on my own competence and my own capability and knowledge base. So of all the different health determinants that we talked about, but focusing on the health services, we may talk about drugs, we may talk about laboratory services, we may talk about infrastructure, we may talk about the computing capability and so on. But I believe the glue that holds all these services together is the workforce, so the human capital. And what I do in my own job, in addition to taking care of patients, is also teaching. And so my interest in global health is also education. And so I'm interested in the education of medical professionals, and I'm interested in the continuous professional development of medical professionals, which means the education and training of people once they have completed their graduate work or their education, have received their degrees, the process by which they maintain their knowledge and proficiency in the field that they are practicing. So I'm interested in that. Beyond that, I'm also interested in science and math and technology education for the children. So those are my interests in global health.
Okay. And then, of course, your expertise and training is also on infectious diseases, and especially in HIV/AIDS, which certainly is a global problem. And it's been over 30 years since the first case was reported. Almost 100 million people have been infected, and 40 million succumbing to the disease. So what is the global status of HIV/AIDS at this time in terms of, you know, incidence, prevalence, mortality, et cetera?
Yeah, I think most of your audience will know that December 1st is World AIDS Day. And what happens on December 1st is the World Health Organization publishes its latest statistics. So the most recent statistics that we have on the global HIV/AIDS epidemic is from December 2014, and that reflects the state of the epidemic from 2013. So there is some lag in the numbers that we have, but I don't think it makes a lot of difference. We know that the disease burden of HIV is immense. There are about 35 million people living with HIV globally. We know about 2 million people were newly infected in 2013. A little bit less than that died from HIV infection in that same year. We know that two-thirds to three-quarters of all HIV infection in the world is found in sub-Saharan Africa, a region which has only about 10% of the world's population. So that is a very brief snapshot of the global HIV AIDS epidemic. There have been successes, so we should note that even with these bad numbers, the number of new infections and the number of deaths is decreasing. The number of people living with HIV is decreasing. The number of people who are on treatment in general is also increasing. Our attempt to identify specific populations who would be a priority area for HIV treatment is also improving. For example, we are accessing more pregnant women to receive the antiretroviral therapy than we did previously. The numbers are still not very good in the ideal world. 100% of women should be receiving HIV treatment, but things are improving, albeit slowly.
Okay. And then the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, PEPFAR, was the largest resource mobilization by any nation to combat a single disease internationally and one of the most successful. It has, since 2013, transitioned to what they call the third phase. And you've been a member of the Scientific Advisory Board, have first-hand knowledge of the program. Can you briefly describe to our audience, you know, what its achievements and the implications of the recent transition is, and whether you're concerned that we'll be losing the momentum of the gains that you just outlined?
That's an excellent question, Anton. So you've described what PEPFAR is. It's the United States President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief. So it's a United States government initiative. It is an initiative that was started by George Bush in mid-2003, 2004, and since then has been renewed and continued by President Obama as well. And in fact, the focus may have been broadened recently. I agree with you 100% that it has been a very successful program. It has, in my eyes, and I think this is not an original observation, I think others would have the same comment, it has done a lot to strengthen countries' abilities to respond to the HIV epidemic, and it has done that by strengthening the country's health system. So it's the kind of tide that floats all boats. So the health systems are strengthened because for HIV, but the health systems remain strengthened for addressing other health needs of the country as well. So it has done a lot to provide anti-HIV drugs to people who need it. And a lot of that improvement in the HIV numbers that I alluded to briefly a few minutes ago can be attributed to PEPFAR and providing medications, providing laboratory support, strengthening health systems, training personnel. So in all aspects of things, the PEPFAR initiative has been very, very helpful and productive and successful in my mind. Now, you properly note that the phase three has to do more with the country ownership, and that has created a lot of anxiety among countries and others who work in these countries as well. That will need to be played out. But at the end of the day, the countries will have to manage their own health system and coordinate and manage their own healthcare workforce and their pharmaceutical supply chain management and things like that. So it is the right direction. Whether it is too soon or not too soon, whether there will be a hiccup in the process, will remain to be seen. But I am hopeful that things will proceed well, but we'll see.
Okay, and then continuing on that same vein, HIV/AIDS has, of course, been the most deadly recent epidemic, but we've had, you know, SARS, more recently we're talking about MERS, and then, of course, there was Ebola. So what have we learned from these outbreaks, especially in terms of disaster management, rapid response readiness, and then, as you mentioned, you know, health infrastructure strengthening? What kind of weaknesses that did the Ebola outbreak reveal?
So, Anton, I will disclose that I am not an Ebola expert. and I don't work in the field of Ebola, but I can say a couple of things that I think of when I think about the Ebola situation. These opinions that I have, again, I don't think are too original. I think a lot of people have them. What the Ebola epidemic has shown is number one, you know, the term that, you know, it's a small world, or the world is small, is no longer a cliche. It really is a small world. There is no country in isolation, and what happens in one country is very likely to impact others around it, and even further away from it. So it is important for people, and by people, not only policymakers, but also ordinary individual folks, to understand and pay attention to these things and not be nihilistic about things that happen far away from your shores, thinking that those things are not going to impact us. So that's, I think that's one thing that we learned. The other thing that we learned is that the health system, partially strengthened by PEPFAR and the HIV epidemic, is still very, very inadequate and very unprepared to respond to situations like this. And not only in a local sense, so the local health system was wholly unprepared to meet these demands, but also the global response was not very comforting or very impressive. So I think those two are major things that are not new, they're not novel, but I think the Ebola epidemic sort of emphasized. So the need for health system strengthening, training individuals, and having a system to monitor situations, communicate with the appropriate individuals, entities, and governments, and international agencies, and to coordinate efforts and focus the efforts where they are needed is something that lacks within countries and globally. And I should point out that there has been a certain development recently to address this in part, and that is the creation of what is being called an African CDC. And the CDC, as people would know, is the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, which is a United States federal agency based in Atlanta, which is a public health agency that oversees these kind of responses for the United States and monitors a number of different health indicators for the United States. What people may not know is that CDC is really the model that other countries follow, and there are things like the European CDC, the Korean CDC, and so on, and people really are, other countries are really trying to model their organizations after the United States CDC. So there is the creation of an African CDC to function as a surveillance and response organization, I guess, with a five regional centers around the continent, but with a coordinating center based in Addis Ababa. So I think that's one development that people may find interesting.
Yeah, that's very encouraging and promising news. I know there's been the effort to establish something of that sort. Probably the Ebola outbreak gave it the further impetus to make it happen. Let's turn to another, you know, major global health problem, which is in your direct field of expertise. You're the you direct the Mayo Clinical Center for Tuberculosis. And this has been, of course, tuberculosis has been with us throughout much of known human history, but it's gained more relevance now with the advent of multidrug-resistant tuberculosis and HIV co-infection. So what does the global landscape look like in terms of tuberculosis and HIV co-infection?
TB is again one of those diseases that transcends boundaries and affects all countries. HIV/AIDS global epidemic report that I mentioned at the onset of our conversation, Anthony. There is also what's called a global report on tuberculosis, or the global tuberculosis report. And the most recent report is again from 2014, reflecting the state of the disease in 2013. So the numbers are also very concerning and worrisome. So about 9 million people came down with tuberculosis in 2013. And the same number of people who died from HIV died from tuberculosis as well, about 1.5 million people. And tuberculosis is the number one cause of death in HIV infection. And there is a very tight relationship between tuberculosis and HIV in many aspects. People who have HIV will have accelerated disease, will progress to active disease more frequently than people without HIV. Their treatment outcomes may be poorer than those without HIV. So there is a lot of interaction between TB and HIV, and the people and the countries and the regions that are affected by HIV are also the same regions that are affected by tuberculosis as well.
You mentioned earlier that, you know, sub-Saharan Africa has a disproportionate burden of the HIV epidemic, accounting for almost 70% of people living with HIV worldwide. And this is despite, you know, as you mentioned, significant advances with PEPFAR and the rest. But less than half have access to antiretroviral treatment. There's been lots of excitement recently with the START study, the strategic timing of antiretroviral treatment. So if you can share with our audience the significance of this study and its implication for resource-constrained countries.
Well, Anthony, you are well informed. I'm pleasantly surprised. So the START study is a multi-center, multinational, prospective randomized clinical trial exploring the answer to this question. And I'll sort of try to give you the historical background. When we started having the first anti-HIV drugs, they were not very good. They were not very patient-friendly. They were toxic, had a lot of adverse events. They were not that effective. We had no good experience with them, so we are unclear about long-term issues from taking these medications. They cost a lot of money. They still cost a lot of money. And so there was an attempt to understand when is the best time to start treatment for HIV. Is it as early as possible? Is it at a certain point, perhaps to be identified through measuring the state of the immune system? And so that discussion and that debate has been ongoing. And part of the debate has also been that there has never been an objective study, a randomized, adequately powered study that has shown that starting early benefits patients. And because of the initial issues, the toxicity issues, the cost issues, the lack of knowledge issues, but also because of resource issues, cost and other resources issues. So there have been artificial boundaries in terms of when to start treatment. And that has been changing over time for a number of reasons. And these reasons include the following. So our drugs that we have now are very effective. They're easier to take, less adverse events, and we are more comfortable in managing their use. Second, we have studies that have shown that beyond the usual things we look for when we look at complications of HIV, there are other bad consequences of not treating HIV. And these bad consequences may not appear to be directly related to HIV on the face of it, because there are things like liver diseases, kidney diseases, heart diseases, and so on, that and cancers that you don't intuitively associate with HIV infection. But in fact, unchecked HIV has been clearly associated with these events. And therefore, we have evolved over the years to accept that treatment is beneficial and it should be started as early as possible. Now, the federal United States guidelines have evolved to the point that they endorse starting treatment as early as possible. Other countries, in particular the European guidelines and the WHO guidelines, have been reluctant to endorse treatment at the higher level of immunity or a higher level of immune state. Because of resource issues, but also with the statement that there is really no objective data to base this on. So what the START study has done is that it has enrolled thousands of patients. It's a large study. Many countries, many sites, and I would just like to add that Mayo Clinic, where I work, is one of the sites, and I'm the principal investigator at Mayo Clinic for the START study. So has divided patients into two, with half of the patients starting treatment early and the other half starting treatment at a lower point based on previous guidelines. What has happened now is a completely independent board that is part of these type of clinical trials has access to the data and monitors the data periodically. And at its most recent session, about a month ago, it realized and discovered that there was a clear penalty to not starting treatment early. In other words, more people who were waiting until their immune status declined before starting therapy came down with diseases, things like tuberculosis, heart disease, kidney disease, and so on, strokes, and those kind of things. And so now, we have the answer. And the answer is yes, there is benefit, clear benefit to starting treatment of HIV as early as possible.
Yeah,
I'm sorry, it was a long-winded answer, but
No. That is a relatively very recent finding that most of our audience will be interested in. But the other angle of it is that, as exciting as this is, we already said with the more conservative treatment cutoff lines, there were about 50% of those in developing countries were not having access to antiretroviral treatment. Did, does this make things even more complicated for countries in planning and in delivering up-to-date HIV care for their citizens?
That's a very good question, and that's a very difficult question to answer, even for people who are involved in directly addressing it on a policy level. But it is true that even using the old guidelines, a substantial number of people who would benefit from treatment are not getting treatment. That is true. And it is true that with these findings and with what probably will be an endorsement globally of this fact, and perhaps there will be a change in the guidelines. The reason why I'm being careful is I just don't want to seem to be able to speak for the WHO and others, because I'm not. So I'm sort of just guessing that what might happen would be an acknowledgement of the findings from START and perhaps a revision of the guidelines to include people with earlier disease to be treated. What it does to the health system is exactly what you said, Antenna. So it will stress the system, a system that's already stressed and is actually not fully coping with meeting previous guideline goals would be stretched even further. But I think we will remove one additional barrier to receiving treatment. And with acknowledgement and realization of this, maybe there will be more resources, and perhaps the country systems are strengthened enough so that they can absorb some of this, but that remains to be seen. That's a good question, but it's a tough question.
Okay, before I open up the lines to the audience, I got one more question on the other spectrum of HIV. In the United States, there's been a recent surge in HIV transmission in rural areas, which is related to injection drug use. So that brings to the fore policy issues like needle exchange and maybe even pre-exposure prophylaxis. So I know, what is the position of the American Academy of HIV Medicine in this issue? And is HIV moving from urban to rural in America?
Yeah, so I don't know that I could make the statement that HIV is moving from urban to rural. I think there are areas of the country that have a higher disease burden than others, and those areas are large urban centers throughout the United States, but also the South. And so that is not anything new. So what you have mentioned is what we have known for some time. HIV treatment has been very successful in the United States, but a substantial number of people who are HIV infected are not aware of their infection. And so they represent a very important pool of people transmitting infection further. And that is why in 2006, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention published its recommendations that everyone should be tested for HIV at least once during a healthcare encounter, and not based on perceived risk, and also not requiring consent or counseling. So I think that has done a lot to perhaps identifying more HIV-infected patients, but that needs to continue. So despite how well we've done, we still have a lot of room to improve. We still have the same number of new HIV infections per year, around 40,000 or so, which tells us that our prevention efforts, and again, whether it's because of sexual safe sex practices or safe injection practices or the like, are not fully successful.
Okay, we are at the halfway mark of our program, and I would like to remind our audience that you're listening to the Global Health Forum, a public service by people to people. I'm your host, Dr. Antana Hapte, and my guest this evening is Dr. Zalalem Temeskin, an infectious disease physician and professor of medicine at Mayo Clinic, where he directs Mayo Clinic's HIV program, Global HIV Education Initiative, and Center for Tuberculosis. He currently serves as the chair of the American Academy of HIV Medicine and is a member of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services Panel on Antiretroviral Guidelines for Adults and Adolescents. Dr. Zalalem is the editor-in-chief of a new journal, the Clinical Journal of Tuberculosis and Other Mycobacterial Diseases, and two books, Mayo Clinic Infectious Disease Board Review Book and Fundamentals of Global HIV Medicine. His bibliography currently lists 94 peer-reviewed papers, 16 book chapters, 2 index letters to the editor, numerous abstracts presented at professional meetings. He has also served as an ad hoc reviewer for a number of journals. We welcome your active participation. You can ask your questions or share your comments by dialing 646-595-4742. Press 1 if you would like to speak. You can also email your questions and comments to info@peoplepeople.org. Let me start out with an email question I got from Belai from Toronto. He says, I have a friend in Ethiopia who has HIV. He's been very sick at one time, but he's doing fairly well now. And I noticed that one of the pills he's taking is Dapsone, which I understand is a medication for leprosy. So why would somebody who has HIV take treatment for leprosy is the question.
I think, without knowing more of the history of this patient, but I think I'm fairly comfortable in answering this, that the reason that he is on Dapsone is not for the treatment of leprosy, but to prevent a very common fungal infection that is associated with HIV called pneumocystis pneumonia. So that is that's the drug that we use, and Dapsone is probably used for that person. And I also would comfortably guess that the reason why he's on Dapsone is because he's allergic to another medication that we use called trimethoprim sulfamethoxazole or Bactrim, which actually is the agent of choice for this. So without knowing your friend, I think it's fairly okay to guess that he is receiving Dapsone to prevent a very common complication of HIV infection, a fungal infection of the lungs.
Okay. Thank you. I have a caller from 203-623. Please go ahead. Hello, caller, are you on the line?
Dr. Antonio, hi, can you hear me?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Great,
yeah.
Perfect. Okay, thank you very much for the show. We appreciate it. Dr. Zalalem, thank you for spending the time as well. My question today is with regards to do medications used to treat HIV infection also help to prevent it? And if so, for high-risk populations like sex workers and intravenous drug users, does it make sense to start them on HIV medications, along with other measures like providing safe needles and condoms?
So the short answer and the short and direct answer is yes. So one of the top areas of HIV treatment is called treatment for prevention. And it's the provision of anti-HIV drugs to prevent HIV infection in those who are at a higher risk for acquiring HIV infection. And those are people who are discordant couples. So husband and wife, one is HIV positive, the other one is negative. And people who are at higher risk, such as the population that you mentioned.
Okay, thank you. Let's go ahead with another caller from area code 571-420.
Hello, Dr.
Yeah, go ahead.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, can hear
Hello.
You.
Thank you very much for the show, Dr. Antonis Skinder from Virginia. I have a question for Dr. Zalalem. When compared to the burden of HIV, how high is it in the U.S. America? I mean, the problem of TB and HIV when it's compared to the situation we have in Ethiopia.
Yes, so, Skender, that's a good question. So, in absolute numbers, the number of HIV-infected people in the United States and in Ethiopia are pretty much the same. It's about 1.1 million people. But remember that there are differences in the size of the population. So the United States has several hundred thousand, several hundred million population. Ethiopia has about 80, 90 million population. So the percentage of people, the prevalence in the United States is about 0.4%. In Ethiopia, it's about 2.1%.
Okay. All righty. Let's move on to the next caller from Toronto, Canada. Go ahead, please.
Hello?
Yeah. Hi, we can hear you. Go ahead.
Okay, wonderful. Good evening, gentlemen. Just a question in regards to vaccination. The HIV virus is said to mutate fast and often. So would developing a vaccination be possible? And if so, does that mean that people would need to be revaccinated every so often?
That's a very good question, a very tough question to answer. But basically your questions are the questions that are being asked by researchers involved actively in vaccine work. So yes, HIV vaccine is an active area of research in HIV medicine. The difficulties with HIV vaccine is that we, even after all these years, we still are not sure exactly what correlates to immunity. And so to provide that patients it has been a big challenge. The other challenge is what you have very rightly pointed out, that the HIV virus mutates very rapidly. The types of the subtypes of HIV that are found in different places around the world are different, and there are various combinations and recombinations of those types, which further worsens the problem. What form the vaccine will take, whether it will require boosting, just as you suggested, is really what is being. People are asking the same question. People who are doing active HIV vaccine research are asking the same questions you're asking.
All right, great. Let's take one more call and have a different area that I would like to cover. Let's take a call from 703-625. Go ahead, please.
Thanks. Very interesting show. My question is just to follow up on the caller who had asked the question. You know, HIV/AIDS, being infected with HIV/AIDS used to mean a death sentence. What is now the quality of life, you know, people who are newly infected with the availability of so many drugs? I mean, has that dramatically changed in terms of the life expectancy? And do you think HIV/AIDS will someday be the thing of the past?
So HIV/AIDS is not a thing of the past. It will be with us for quite some time, for the lifetime of all of us and beyond. However, the treatment has come to has advanced so much that the kind of things that bother us, one would be pill burden. So when the first combination regimens came to the clinical practice, patients were taking 18, 20, 22 pills daily in a three times daily regimen. Very hard to take medications, hard on the stomach, all sorts of different toxicities. Now, we have co-formulated single pill regimens that all of your HIV treatment is just one single pill once daily. And not only that, those pills are reasonably easy to take and reasonably easy to tolerate. And so, yes, most of our patients, those who are on treatment, are doing well. And those who start treatment early and stay on treatment will have a very good quality of life and probably have the same lifespan as if they were not infected.
All right, great. I apologize for the callers who are waiting on the line. I'll take one more call from area 252, and then I want to discuss a lot of your activities in Ethiopia in the remaining time that we have. So 252, go ahead, please.
Hi, Zalalem and Antenna. This is Daud. Nice talk. Great topic, really. Just one follow-up. I just want to, Dr. Zalalem, to clarify for us. One of the callers was asking about the prevalence and incidence of HIV, a comparison between our country and here in the U.S. I think probably what we have to emphasize, Dr. Zalalem, maybe you might have to explain that a little bit more, is between the migrants who are coming to this country or who live in segregated communities in this country and the overall general population of U.S. is a little bit significantly actually different, and that might be of importance to us Ethiopians who live in this country. The other thing that you said that I want to emphasize really is the life expectancy. For those who take medication, really, life expectancy of HIV now has improved dramatically, and that's something that we have to take into account. Thank you.
So thank you, Daud. Good to hear from you. For those of you who might not know him, Dr. Daud Siraj is also an infectious disease and HIV specialist at East Carolina University. So the comments and the questions are proper. So the answer I gave was comparing the United States and Ethiopia HIV epidemics. So what Dr. Daud is pointing out, and very rightly, that in the United States, among recent immigrants, so let me back up. In general, in the United States, HIV is also a disease of minorities. So a substantial proportion of the population who are newly infected and are living with HIV are minorities. But above and beside this, there is also a fairly worrisome epidemic among recent immigrants. So we see proportionally we see HIV also, and recent immigrants from Africa and from areas where HIV is more of a problem than here in the United States. And among those people, Ethiopians living in the United States are among the top in terms of being affected by HIV. So this is something that those of us who live in the United States should also understand. And I hope that's what you are alluding to, Daud. The second question was this affirmation that the longevity is good if people get treated early and stay on treatment.
Okay. All right. I'm going to switch gears here and talk a little bit about your activities in Ethiopia. I know you travel to Ethiopia quite often. So if you could tell us a little bit about the activities you're involved in and your counterparts there.
So my major activity in Ethiopia is in a program called Human Resources for Health. And it is a program supported by the CDC through PEPFAR funds. And my part in that is fairly small and modest, but what I do is develop programs to educate medical professionals on HIV and HIV-related issues. And the way that we have elected to do this is by providing this education online, electronically, on a website. And the reason for that is that this will allow us to reach as many people as possible. It is cost-effective. It is something that busy professionals can consume at their own pace. And it also is fairly and relatively easy to monitor and track and reward. So this program, which we call the HIV e-curriculum series, is what we have been working on over the last few years, and I'm still doing so.
Okay.
The way we've done, you asked me about counterparts, I'd like to mention that. So, so the way we've done this is the topics are priorities of the country. So the Ministry of Health and local professionals direct what the topics are. The program itself, the content itself, initially was produced by putting Ethiopian professionals and United States professionals together to produce the content jointly. In more recent years, we're working directly from the Ministry of Health manuals on various topics and working on them, reviewing them, revising them for content and so on, and putting them online and conducting the training in that regard. So our colleagues and counterparts, professional counterparts from Ethiopia, the Ministry of Health, the CDC, both in Ethiopia and the United States are counterparts. And then people like yourself, Dr. Antone, Dr. Dawood, and other Ethiopian and non-Ethiopian medical professionals in the United States and in Canada and in Europe have also participated in being the subject matter expert and content provider for our programs.
All right. I probably have time for one more question. Let me take a call from 708-975. Please go ahead.
This is Ken from Chicago area, Dr. Zalalem and Dr. Antone. Thank you for a very informative session, and it's very interesting and very useful. I just wanted to, a couple of questions I have, mostly for the audience sake, really. There is a notice or an awareness of the fluctuation of the incidence of TB in the U.S., I remember when I was practicing, there was a time when we were very much worried about the kids we were seeing, quite a number of them with infection with tuberculosis, either active in some way, but with some evidences. This is the first thing I want you to comment on briefly. The other thing is when we were talking about Ethiopians, about the HIV incidence or prevalence in general in the U.S. is quite significant. I imagine that TB also holds that caliber, and we're trying to educate really the people to be aware of that and get the take the advantage of being checked and examined and treated. That's the second one, and BC will be the third. Any comments about the use of BCG? Of course, the U.S. doesn't use BCG now, but as far as your exposure to Ethiopia's tuberculosis activities, what could you comment about BCG?
So I agree with your first two comments. I'm not sure, Dr. Kinfer, what the first question was. If you can just repeat it for me.
The first one?
Yes.
It is about the fluctuation of the incidence of TB in the United States. Now, I suppose it is sort of falling slightly down. And there were times when it was quite significantly high, particularly in children, sometime in the past. And we do notice that fluctuation. Would it be dependent on immigrants, the population of immigrants, or are there any other factors?
So I will understand the question. So I will say that the HIV, this is in fact even true for Minnesota, where I am, that the HIV diagnosis among African immigrants, among people born in Africa and came to the United States, is higher than what you would see from the general HIV population. And so what the exactly what this is from, and is this coming here undiagnosed? Is this because of travels back and forth to Ethiopia? What is the exact, you know, epidemiologic profile of these people? I don't know, and I don't think it's very well understood. But it is clear that the rates among African immigrants is higher than the general population.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of TB, I think your comment stands on its own. I agree with that. TB, there are 22 countries in the world which are designated as high TB burden countries, and Ethiopia is one of those 22 high tuberculosis burden countries. The third comment was about BCG, and I'm not exactly sure what you are alluding to in terms of my comment, but for the audience, BCG stands for Bacille Calmette-Guérin, which is a weakened strain of tuberculosis that is used to vaccinate people, in particular children, against tuberculosis. So it is a practice that is very common in many countries around the world, and the provision of BCG does actually prevent the subsequent development of development of TB in those who are vaccinated. So that's we don't do this in the United States because the burden of disease in the United States is not that high, and providing BCG not only will not be cost-effective, but will also hinder the subsequent ability to diagnose tuberculosis, infection, and disease. And I hope that's what you wanted me to say, that to confirm.
Yeah.
But,
okay.
All
yeah,
right, so in the last few minutes we have left, Dalalam, I wanted to ask you what your future career plans are and what you see as challenges or barrier to success.
Well, I would like to continue doing the same kind of work that I am doing, which is promoting and helping with science and technology and math education for kids and professional medical education and continuous professional development. Now, how much of that I will continue to be able to do is dependent on what is the funding atmosphere to support those kind of activities. But I'm pretty sure that in one way or the other, I would be working in this area in addition to my daily job of infectious disease as well. Yeah.
And in the other area, if you can say a few words about what you've recently ventured in is service innovation. Can you kind of, in a few words, describe what that means and what it's trying to achieve?
So I got introduced into an area that I was not familiar with, and that's called service science. And it's a term coined by IBM a few years ago. It's basically a discipline which brings together people from all walks of life to focus on a certain area of need. And we talk about multidisciplinary teams in our practice, Antenna, and we mean by that, you know, physicians and nurses and other allied health and pharmacists and so on. But this is much more than that. This is just this is also not just medical people, but physicians and engineers and policy people and financial people and so on to work together on such activities. So we took a group of engineers and physicians to Baharda University and to see how we can support the medical school at Baharda University, not only by providing support for medical education or subspecialty training or curriculum or so on, but also by using engineering solutions for health and trying to see if there are any needs for physical infrastructure, computing infrastructure, and so on and so forth. So that was a very exciting visit, and I'm sure something will come out of it, but time will tell.
All right, that sounds very interesting and innovative. This brings us to the conclusion of our program. I'd like to thank my guest, Dr. Zalalem Temeskin, Professor of Medicine and Infectious Disease Consultant at Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. So thank you for joining us this evening, Zalalem.
My pleasure, Antana. Thank you.
And I want to thank you, the audience, for tuning into the Global Health Forum. We invite you to join us every Thursday at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. As always, you can help shape our program by submitting your comments and suggestions through info@peoplepeople.org or People to People's Facebook page. And you can also access the archive show using the link on the People to People website. Brief program update before I sign off. The first Thursday of next month, July 2nd, I'll be hosting Dr. Neil Prose, Professor of Pediatrics and Dermatology at Duke University in Durham, North Carolina. Dr. Prose has extensive experience in developing countries and has prepared protocols and teaching manuals in dermatology. He has also developed new models for teaching empathic doctor-patient communication to medical students, residents, and practicing physicians in all fields of medicine. He was recently at Gonder University and is in the process of collaborating with the staff and faculty there to incorporate a course in doctor-patient relationship in the medical school curriculum. Please check our website for more details on this and other upcoming topics and guests. I'm your host, Dr. Antana Hapte, and you're listening to the Global Health Forum, a public service brought to you by People to People. Thank you for your support and stay engaged.